This paid program may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. Sound financial management is essential to the effective stewardship of taxpayer dollars and enabling agency decision makers to make tough choices on day-to-day and long-term management challenges. The U.S. Department of Labor continues to improve performance and its operations. Managing its resources efficiently and effectively is key. In an era of tight budgets, this charge has taken on a new significance beyond the fundamentals, to ensuring the improvement of financial management within the department. What are the financial management priorities of the U.S. Department of Labor? How is labor improving its operations, becoming more efficient, and controlling costs? What is labor doing to reduce and eliminate improper payments? And how is labor working to transform the way it does business? We'll explore these questions and so much more with our very special guest, Jim Taylor, Chief Financial Officer at the U.S. Department of Labor. Jim, welcome to the show. It's great to have you.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Also joining our conversation from IBM is Steve Watson. Steve, as always, welcome.
Well, thanks, Mike.
So, Jim, before we get into specific initiatives, I'd like to get some context. Could you give us a sense of the history and mission of the U.S. Department of Labor?
Yeah, I'd be happy to, Michael. And it's really a pleasure to be here. The fascinating thing is that after 30 years in the government, I came to the Department of Labor about 2 years ago. And I thought I knew about the Labor Department, what it did. However, once you get there, you really do get a sense for how important it is in the lives of virtually every American. The department's history is a good place to start because we'll be observing our 100th anniversary next year. We began gearing up for our centennial just before Labor Day this year, and we'll be having a symposium reflecting on our history and looking forward to the challenges of the coming decades in November. The department's newsletter is already running Centennial Moments, and that's available on www.dol.gov, hard to remember. The Department of Labor was actually established in March 1913 by President Taft. 2 years later, in 1915, the Bureau of Labor Statistics launched its monthly labor review. It's a publication that continues today and includes information about labor force, the economy, employment, inflation, productivity, wages, and other very timely topics. The 1930s and 40s were incredibly important decades for the department. FDR named Frances Perkins, our building's named for her now, as his Secretary of Labor, and she became the first woman appointed to the cabinet. She was in office for 12 years, starting in 33, longer than any other Secretary of Labor. She was the principal architect of the Social Security Act of 1935, which I didn't know, and the Federal Minimum Wage Act. She oversaw the creation of the Unemployment Insurance Program and fought against abusive child labor practices throughout the country. Today, the department, led by Secretary Hilda Solis, administers or enforces in whole or in part about 100 laws, and it touches the world of work, employee benefits and pensions, job training, veterans employment, occupational safety and health, mine safety, fair labor standards, and the collection and reporting of key labor statistics. So I'd say 100 years later, I think this mission is just as important as it was when they first passed the act.
So it's such an important mission. I'd like to get a sense of the scale of operations that you support. How is DOL organized? What's the size of your budget, number of full-time employees? And could you give us a sense of the geographical footprint?
Sure. I mean, to be honest, I mean, we're in virtually every city and virtually in every state and in every territory and in many foreign countries. Like I said before, you know, we touch the lives of almost all Americans one way or another. For example, labor administers a wide range of employment programs. Our Employment and Training Administration served 39.7 million Americans during the height of the recession from July 2009 to June of 2010, including 22 million people who received career counseling. we prepare people leaving the military for careers in the civilian sector. This coming year, we expect to provide 5,700 employee workshops at military installations to an estimated 200,000 military service members coming home. We help keep workers safe. Our Occupational Safety, Health, and Administration provides free on-site assistance to about 30,000 small and medium-sized businesses and employ more than 1.5 million workers. Our Mine Safety and Health Administration works to reduce deaths and injuries at more than 14,000 mines. Our Employee Benefits Security Administration oversees 700,000 private sector retirement plans, 2.3 million health plans, and other workplace-related benefit plans to cover more than 141 million Americans. And to ensure that Americans can provide for their families and keep what they earn, 2011, the Wage and Hour Division collected more than $224 million in back wages, a record amount for that year, for any year, and helped more than 275,000 American workers. So we really do reach out and we touch everybody. We have a budget of about $17 billion in discretionary funding, but we spent over $224 billion in 2011, and in 2012, more like $90 billion. The majority of that is for unemployment benefits. We also have a workers' compensation program, Federal Employees Compensation Act, for injured federal workers that covers hundreds of thousands of federal workers who are injured on the job, Postal Service, TSA, every agency in the government. We also provide benefits to black lung sufferers, as well as employees who are injured in the industries who are building up the nuclear power plants. So they have a special benefit program as well. So those activities, in addition to our training and education activities, are really vital, I think, to the American workers.
Jim, thanks for that overview. Now that you've given us that overview, can you dig a little bit into the CFO's office? What are your responsibilities? How large is your office? How is your team organized? And how does your office support the mission that you just described?
Sure. As CFO, I'm responsible for about 160 federal staff. We have a lot of contractors in addition to that, but really what we are responsible for is financial policy, financial operations, all external reporting, budget execution for the department's programs. We have all the budget activities for all the smaller agencies. The larger agencies have their own financial operations, so we're pretty decentralized. That's why my staff is fairly small. We work through the agencies, and all the large agencies or larger agencies have their own financial operations. So it's really that collaborative exercise is really critical to our department. We also have the financial systems. We're responsible for the core financial reporting system for the department. We're centralized. There's one financial reporting system. There are CUF systems, as we call them, in different places. But the system of record is maintained by my office. We have travel operations, travel policy, personnel and payroll reporting, and the department's working capital fund, about $500 million of activity that supports the front office activities and programs, and all financial and budget support for the 20 or so smaller agencies. We also are responsible for all the internal controls and IPR activities in the department, A123, as well as reviewing, and the new one of the newer really glory jobs in every CFO's life is reviewing all conferences for approval in the department. And we also are leading the effort on the president's campaign to cut waste.
So, Jim, regarding those responsibilities and duties, what are some of your top challenges, management challenges you face in your role, and how have you sought to address them?
Well, there are no lack of challenges that we've had. One was our financial management system. It's called the NuCore Financial Management System, or just NuCore. NuCore was a challenge. It was a contract that was signed several years ago. It is the first cloud implementation department-wide for a financial reporting system. And it replaced a 20-year-old system that was not integrated with anything and that a lot of people liked because it was very easy to use. You didn't have to worry too much about funds control. You didn't have to worry too much about having to do much reporting because the system was very flexible. The second major challenge that I have is the skills, financial skills throughout the department. When I first sat down with our chief operating officer, the deputy secretary, Seth Harris, and discussed the kinds of things he would want me to do if I came to the department, that was number one was obviously straightening out the financial system. But number two was improving the financial capabilities throughout the department. And we have decentralized operations. We have a lot of financial people. And we've had a way of doing things for 20 years that's changed dramatically. And so doing a skills assessment and doing the planning and doing the training to improve those skills to match what we need to do going forward is really my second big challenge.
So given your experience, Jim, what are some of the characteristics of an effective leader?
You know, I used to play basketball in high school, and we had something called court awareness. It's knowing your environment. You know,
like situational awareness.
Situational awareness. You've got to know. You manage because management is situational, as you know. And you know, when you're getting ready to pass a basketball, you know, you got to make sure that no one's ready to intercept it. No one's coming up behind you fast. You just got to have a feel for it. And in management, you have to. Not every management theory fits every single situation. You know, and we're all exposed to a plethora of training classes and great books on management, and they're very useful. But a lot of what it all boils down to is really using common sense, and which is, I think, tremendously underrated, and to understand what's going on around you. You know, you've got to listen to what's going on. You've got to know your clients. You've got to know what they want and what they expect from you. And then, you know, I think the key thing is to set your priorities and don't be afraid to say no. That's the hardest thing, particularly in the federal government. We try to help everybody. We try to do everything, and none of our clients or our stakeholders, like the Congress or OMB, want to hear no. And so you want to be parsimonious when you use that, but you want to use it, and don't be afraid to say no, and stick with those priorities. You know, I think it's hard for managers to stay focused on their priorities, and so you stay focused on them and then deliver. And I think that to me, people who do that are the ones who are the most successful.
What are the financial management priorities at Labor? We will ask Jim Taylor, Chief Financial Officer at the U.S. Department of Labor, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. How do we lead in an era of complex challenges? What is DOD doing to change the way it does business? How is EPA incorporating sustainability into its regulatory decision-making? What does USDA do to promote the country's agricultural production and exports? And how is New York City leveraging technology to deliver human services? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. We bring you insights and interviews from government executives who are changing the way government does business. Download or order a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Jim Taylor, Chief Financial Officer at the U.S. Department of Labor. Also joining us from IBM is Steve Watson. So, Jim, I'd like to get a sense of your strategic vision. Could you tell us a little bit more about the key strategic financial management priorities in your office, and what are you doing to address them?
Sure, we really have two. I mentioned the financial management system, but I think one of our real important things that we have going forward now is we've got to use that. Having an integrated financial system means that you can go end to end, that you can process a document from beginning all the way through to the end and interface it with all activities. They never had that before. Now we have that. We can provide information to managers about their procurement activities, their grants activities, you know, and their travel. There are things we can do in one place that would have required a data call before. Mm-hmm. And so now, you know, we can do all that. But the challenge is making it happen for the managers. You know, these systems that we've been designing since the CFO Act was passed in 1990 aren't just to meet reporting requirements that we have, you know, really neat-looking financial statements, things like that. I like neat-looking financial statements because it's what I do, but that's not really what this should be about. It should be about getting managers actionable information and getting them things they can use to make solid decisions. We're doing a pilot project now with one of our offices to try to identify exactly what is it she wants to be able to manage her field staff and her programs and try to provide that kind of reports. Because the problem is that many times managers, I mean, the people that come to run these programs are amazing individuals. They're dedicated. They know their topic. But they don't know financial systems. They don't know financial – I'm the one that does that. So they don't know what to ask for. So instead of having them try to figure out how to get the stuff out, here, you know, just saying, here's a buffet. I've laid this all out for you. Here, come and eat. You know, I need to find out exactly what it is they want and what they're trying to accomplish, and then I can try to figure out if my data can meet it, and if not, how can I get that data? So we're working on that now, and that's the exciting part of it. Clean audit opinions are necessary. You have no credibility if you don't have them, and you have nothing but problems if you do. The second thing is a skills assessment. And I mentioned that that was the number two thing that the Deputy Secretary mentioned that he felt like I had to focus on. And right now, we have already gone through a process where we brought together subject matter experts from all of the agencies. They identified every financial person in the department, be they a budget person, systems accountant, or some journalist who does financial stuff but doesn't have it in their title. And they also identified for us every skill that should be required at every level for those positions. I've been around a few of these efforts before where, you know, once you identify what the training needs are, you have a really nice binder, great presentation, great set of slides, and you hand it over to the program managers and you say, here you go. Wipe your hands, check the box, and you move on. You declare a victory. That doesn't work. What works is staying on top of it, staying focused.
You've mentioned a couple of times a new core financial system. I'd like to delve a little bit deeper into that. I hadn't realized it was a cloud offering either, a cloud service. Could you tell us a little bit about the transition to this system? What were some of the lessons you've learned from this change, and how are you using it today?
The good news is that I have a job as CFO because of the core financial system. But the agency was increasingly having problems with the old system. The old system wasn't, I don't even call it a system, I think it's kind of a loose term, but it was 20 plus years old. It met the requirements of the time, and people were comfortable using it. And that becomes part of the problem at times. Everybody's very comfortable using it. It wasn't integrated with anything. You have a procurement action, you know, you fill out your form, you throw it over the wall to try to get the funding code right and get it all approved by the budget folks. And a few days later, somebody would come back. You know, they moved forward with it. They had a couple of false starts. They had about $50 million that went to waste because they just couldn't get it going. This effort was like the third iteration of trying to get it going, and they were having problems again. And part of it was perception. I mean, not just part of it. I think a lot of it was perception. When they've had several failed efforts, it's never happened. This one has been delayed. There have been delays in this one. They're not going to take us too seriously out there. They've got a lot of work to do, and it's hard to take this seriously. And they were required to go to training, but the problem is that you can lead the horse to training, but you can't make them learn how to use Nucor. And the other part was it was very, very different. The good news is it's all integrated. It's all online. The bad news is when you enter something, you get immediate feedback. Now, you would think that's good, but it's going to be bad, too, because if that procurement action doesn't have the right accounting code, doesn't have all the information, you get the big red light, nothing happens. And you have to fix it before it'll go in. And that was frustrating a lot of people. And that was a training challenge. We don't need this proliferation of, you know, all these financial systems. We need to standardize how we do our reporting. We need to take a look at the reporting that we require. And we also need to make things simpler because we're not that different. You go to the Department of Commerce, you know, even though they have a lot fewer zeros, they have every type of account the Department of Defense has, all the same accounts. They have the military accounts. They have ships, the NOAA Ocean Service. They have everything that DOD has. So we're not all that unique. We always think we're unique, and there's sometimes a little twist, but we're really not that unique. And so we can develop these shared services implementations, and we can make it work. The thing you have to learn is you have to plan better. Sometimes I do feel like I'm dealing with my airline, you know, where they've outsourced their help desk function, you know, and people don't have any idea what I'm going through. There are times you do feel like that, but you need to be able to understand this reach out and touch thing that we all think we have to have. When I do my financial reporting at any other place, I don't have the server sitting in front of me. I'm not hard coding the requirement. I'm using software that someone else provided, is sitting somewhere else, and I'm using connections that aren't anywhere near my desk. So I think once we get used to that and get a different kind of mentality about it, I think it will be very, very successful. I think that's one of the big lessons. It takes getting used to. And, you know, I'm a very control-oriented person, being a CFO. We kind of migrate to these kind of jobs. But it can work, and it can save billions of dollars in the long run.
Let me stay on the topic of the financial management system. Transparency, accountability are the foundation for effective financial management. How has the transition to the new financial system helped labor move towards the administration's goals of providing clear and more accessible information to stakeholders?
Yeah, I think the first step in that is being able for managers in the department to understand what's going on. And I think that's a huge first step. You know, before you can be transparent to your stakeholders, you got to be transparent to your own management. And I think that what we've been able to do is provide that transparency already. We had a report that we provide the deputy secretary. Now, this is a simple obligation trend report. And it's nothing super sophisticated. It's basically all it is it takes the last 5 years of obligations for all of our programs and compares the trends for this year. So this year's rate of obligation compared to that and says, okay, you'll have variations year to year, but over a five-year period, you can pretty much get an idea of how much money we ought to be spending in mine safety, how much money we ought to be spending in OSHA, how much money we ought to be spending at Bureau of Labor Statistics. You know, those activities, they don't differ that dramatically. But even if they do, that smoothing is taken into account visually. So we provide that for every program. And when the deputy secretary meets with the assistant secretaries in charge of these programs, that's the information he uses. So that's just a small first step. So that transparency within our own department is new. Going outside, we can provide information in a far more timely basis to our stakeholders in the Congress than we ever could before. We can give them more assurance of internal controls than we ever could before. We can do better information for data sets to analysts who do the projections, who do the risk analysis. So I think all those things, I think, give us the ability to be more transparent and to make sure that everybody understands where we are. You know, as I keep saying, I think the Department of Labor has a great story to tell. But if you can't get the information to individuals to tell the story, you know, it's lost.
Let me go ahead and change the topic to improper payments. Could you tell us about the initiatives and strategies the department has employed and you've employed to successfully manage and reduce improper payments? What remains to be done to eliminate improper payments?
Sure. In the last 2 years, as the designated official on improper payments, I've been very much involved in our major programs in trying to reduce the rate of improper payments. The largest program that we have for improper payments is the large program we have, which is the Unemployment Insurance Program. We have over $114 billion spent in 2011 and about $97 billion on this activity in 2012. During the recession, as the states were being stressed and trying to provide more benefits, they took the people that run the programs because it's a state-run program. We have legislatively, this is a very decentralized program. And so the states actually run it, they carry out the program, and they have a lot of independence. We can establish ourselves basic rules, but they can actually add to those. They can have more requirements than the feds do, and they do. For example, many states have a requirement that you have to be looking for work in order to collect benefits. That's a state requirement. However, if the state doesn't enforce that requirement they've identified, it becomes an improper payment for the program. You know, we can't tell them a lot of what they need to do necessarily. We can work with them, we can provide technical assistance, but that's part of our ongoing problem. That said, we're not off the hook. There's a lot of work that needed to be done, and we've been doing it. Something as simple, even if you don't have the legislative authority to say, you know, go and stop this or mandate certain activities or get data that we can't get from the IRS and from other places, you know, because even within government, information sharing is very sensitive. And so it's difficult for us to get some of the information that would be useful in this. I understand all the reasons why. It's just the fact that if we had other data, maybe we could move faster on some things. But it, you know, we have to address the situation as we find it, court awareness. And so as a result, we can cajole. We can provide technical assistance. We can provide grants. And we gave over $100 million last year in administrative grants, largely to help make things more efficient and to help them improve their systems. California has a system that is still COBOL. So it's hard for us to compare that to other states who have far more modern system and to share data. We do have a state information data sharing activity called SIDES, where states who are contiguous share information on employment data and share that information. As a result, you know, you can't declare benefits, ask for benefits in one state and be working in another state. That's been very effective. Something as simple as identifying the states that are worst offenders on a website has been a tremendous help. And one of the states recently took the initiative to do something that we've talked about for a number of years and compared their prisoner database to their beneficiary database. And they came out and they came out and identified 1,200 inmates who were collecting unemployment insurance, and they stopped it. You know, those kind of positive things are going on. The program identified a number of states that really needed, that really like the worst offenders or needed a lot of help, and focused technical assistance, grant funds to try to help improve their knowledge, their systems, and whatever else they could do to try to reduce the improper payment rate. They did all those things, and out of about six states were identified, five has significantly reduced their improper payment rate in 1 year. And the rate, in fact, in 2011, the rate was 12%. It's down to 11.4%. It's a small drop, but it's big for us. And the impact is you go, because the base also dropped, the amount of money we also pay out in unemployment benefits dropped, you went from essentially $13 billion in improper payments down to 10. So we say, so that's a $3 billion drop in 1 year. So we think we're on the right track. We're taking a huge advantage of the Do Not Pay initiative that Treasury has going on, where they're trying to centralize a lot of the databases that, and to identify who should and should not be collecting benefits, not just for an employment program, but also for our Black Lung program, for our FICA program, for our other activities. The OMB identified our plan as one of the best in government and shared it with other agencies that said, this is what you guys ought to be looking at, because we think it's a huge benefit. And we think going forward, as Treasury improves their ability to provide technical assistance in this area, we're going to take full advantage of that, too, and work with them hand in hand. We've also worked closely with CMS on Medicaid and Medicare. We still have legislatively a more difficult road, I think, than even the Medicaid folks do. But there's a lot we can learn as we all move forward. So we're going to work very closely with them as well as the Treasury. So we're really pretty positive, I think, about how we're moving forward.
I want to talk about another program which you alluded to earlier, and that's the eGov travel program, the travel program. Could you tell us a little bit about the program? What are some of the significant benefits associated with the program? Are you doing any enhancements there?
There's a new contract that was just signed by GSA, which everybody is migrating to. The plan is for next November, if not before. Our activity is centralized. So the eGov system and Department of Labor is centralized in my office. And it was a huge change when it was implemented a number of years ago before I came there. And it was interesting because when I first met with the unions at labor, I had not been on board very long. And so I assumed that I was going to get just skewered over Nucor, over the financial system. But when I met with them, the biggest issue was the travel system. And I think there are a lot of flexibilities, I think, in the travel system. I think they were looking for and enhancements that they would like to have had the department wasn't able to implement. But I think going forward, I think as we're moving into the new contract, I think we will be able to provide that. We really have a lot of folks who are constantly on the road traveling, the inspectors in the mines, the OSHA inspectors, the folks looking at pension plans, they travel a tremendous amount. And so for us, you know, having our clients be happy with the travel system is huge. And being able to do more and more mobile is, you know, that technology is going to be huge for us going forward. So those are the enhancements we're looking for.
How is labor working to transform the way it does business? We will ask Jim Taylor, CFO at the U.S. Department of Labor, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. What does the USDA do to promote the country's agricultural production and exports? How is EPA incorporating sustainability into its regulatory decision-making? What is the military health system's quadruple aim? How is the Maritime Administration working to enhance U.S. competitiveness? And what about DHS's acquisition and procurement strategies? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. We bring you insights and interviews from government executives who are changing the way government does business. Hear from U.S. Deputy Secretary Kathleen Merrigan, David Matsuda, Administrator of the U.S. Maritime Administration, and Dr. Jonathan Woodson, Assistant Secretary of Defense for Health Affairs. Robert Hale and Beth McGrath provide us with their insights on how DOD is changing the way it does business and leading in an era of complex challenges. All of this and more in the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine. Order a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Jim Taylor, Chief Financial Officer at the U.S. Department of Labor. Also joining us from IBM is Steve Watson. So, Jim, strong stewardship of taxpayers' resources requires rigorous internal controls. Would you elaborate on your efforts to embed and mature an internal control model within your organization? What are some of the challenges you face in that area?
Yeah, well, internal controls is near and dear to my heart. What we wanted to do instead was come up with a management-based approach where management is looking at their internal controls and assessing them themselves, not a gotcha approach, and not something another requirement auditors had to do. And so we wanted to identify what are the weaknesses and how should management address the weaknesses and how can we improve things so that management would want to make those changes instead of, you know, the knee-jerk reaction is, well, the auditors don't understand. And it's, but if it's your own staff doing this, guided by people who maybe understand the process, you know, and assisted where necessary by contractors or subject matter experts, those are the things that I think are positive. So that's when we came up with that, that was the intent. At Labor, we're carrying out that effort. The deputy secretary has taken a personal interest in this because he realized how important the internal controls are. It's not just in and of themselves they are, because they are, but it's also everything is about perception. And so that's why you want clean opinions, and that's why you want good internal controls. What we're trying to do different in our internal controls is we wanted to make it useful. So we're taking a risk-based approach. We're focusing our efforts on those programs which really haven't looked at as much. To me, that's what we're doing. That's really interesting.
Jim, given the significant fiscal and economic pressures the country is facing, I understand the department has embarked on a department-wide cost-cutting effort. Would you tell us more about your efforts to cut costs and realize savings? What are some of the key initiatives being pursued within labor to achieve cost reductions?
Sure, I'd be happy to. I told my staff when I was given that assignment that they don't have to worry about overscheduling holiday parties this year, because no one's going to invite us anywhere, because we're the ones in charge of reducing all these costs and reviewing the conferences as well. So we're really proud of how far we've come. For us, travel's a huge thing. We have a lot of cars out there because a lot of our inspectors use vehicles. We have a lot of vehicles, and we took a hard look at those. We have a lot of travel. We looked at the travel and tried to figure out ways to combine the travel, what was really necessary. We looked at desktop devices and things like that to try to reduce. We even reduced $180,000 in awards, not by saying you're not going to get an award, but by saying, you know, some of the awards will be the paper award you hand out. But at the Secretary's Awards Ceremony, the highest honors weren't things we went out and paid a lot of money for. They were awards that were actually made at the Job Corps training centers. These really beautiful things were made as part of a training activity. It was a great way, it was a great symbiotic way to get these things done. And I was very impressed by that. So we've just in something like that, we saved $180,000. The goal is to reduce travel overall by 30% by the end of 2013. That's the stated goal that OMB has. And the beauty of this is that it's truly, and the way we can sell this in my job is that it's truly a way to look at how to re-engineer how you do business. What the president really wants us to do is take a look at how we do things. And this is an initiative to do that, because it's not cutting our budget, our travel budget, by 30%. What they're saying is take that money and apply it to increasing the benefits or increasing the program activities, doing something else other than traveling. And, you know, and with technology the way it is, you know, are there things that we can do to get around having to travel as much as we do? There are times you cannot. You know, there's no way you're going to remotely do a mine safety inspection. You know, you need to meet with those who are managing the pension benefits of an organization to understand a lot of what they're up to. But there's a lot of prep work you can do before you do that. And so we think that we have a lot of great activities on due to the savings. And to answer your question, Steve, it's mainly in the travel area. And we have no qualms at all about meeting a 30% reduction by the end of this fiscal year over the 2010 number. And that's with more staff on board.
Jim, a successful CFO organization requires financial expertise in, I guess, IT, analytics. You've touched on that. Obviously, financial expertise, accounting, and I'm sure other diverse competencies as well. What are you doing to ensure you have a well-trained and technical workforce to meet your mission challenges, and how do you cultivate the next generation of leadership?
Well, that's a constant challenge, isn't it? And it's more challenging when you know that administrative costs are the first thing that are reduced and when you're trying to reduce deficits. And that's just the way life is. In our case, when I got there, we had about 100 people. We've hired 48 new staff in 2 years. These are new people. These aren't people I promoted internally. These are new people coming in with new skills because we couldn't match up our requirements with the skill sets we had on board. We had people to do some jobs very, very well. But the job had changed. Some of the jobs had changed, and we had new jobs we had to do. And one of the biggest failures of the implementation that we had with the new financial system was that the CFO's office just didn't have the bench, the resources, to be able to support that activity and support the agencies. And you can't, some things you just can't do totally with contractors and outside entities. You've got to be able to have that workforce yourself. Retaining the talent, no matter how tough times get, my promise is that we will reward those who are doing an exceptional job. We'll find a way. If it's time off awards, I'll buy you lunch. I don't care anything, but we will find a way to reward this. And that's why I tell the staff, if you're coming to work and you're doing your job, you're going to get your salary. But if you're doing something that's really moving us forward, then you're going to get rewarded. And we'll always find a way to do that because that's the way you keep those folks. So those are the things that we're doing to get more talent in and to try to keep them.
Now, Jim, the next area I want to talk about reaches into the new folks that you're bringing on, but it also talks about some of the things we used to discuss. And it was a question I used to ask, and it was about the retirement tsunami, which back at 6 years ago, we were talking about it, but it's coming to fruition now. So with the new folks you have coming on board and presumably the folks that are leaving, what are you doing around the area of knowledge management and institutional knowledge retention?
Well, I think we talked about skills assessment in great detail before, but to be honest, that's one of the key things is making sure that throughout the department, and in my office in particular, that we have the skill sets required to do the functions that we're in right now. And to make sure that no matter what happens, that you've got the right levels of folks who are moving up, who have developed that skill set, are ready to take the next step forward. Because the people we're going to use are going to be usually the higher graded folks, and the folks that are taking a lot of knowledge with them, so we've got to constantly be replenishing that supply. It will be difficult. And like most folks have been around a long time, I got tired of hearing about the retirements. I just got tired of hearing about it. But you're right. It is here. And the numbers are incredible that OPM's reporting. And so, like everybody else, I'm looking for qualified accounts. I'm looking for qualified IT people. But, I'm also looking for people that know how to think and know how to act independently and know how to analyze information. So I think that gives us a little bit of an edge that maybe because we're looking out for people that have some good general skills, I'm not going to make them all CPAs. And they don't want me to. But I can use them in a lot of the functions we perform. So it is going to be difficult, I think. And I think by making these systems far more efficient, we have the ability to process things a lot more efficiently than we could before. Do we need the number of payment centers that we've had traditionally because we can now route a payment, electronically? Doesn't matter where in the country it comes from. It's going to come by email. We're going to pay it electronically. It doesn't matter where you sit anymore. Those kind of things will help us reduce the number of people that have to have a particular skill. There's still need to make sure they're working with the vendors at their local area in their office. However, do they have to understand the accounts payable process in order to make this happen? I want to make it easier on them so they don't have to be accounts payable experts in order to get an invoice, paid.
I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about financial reporting models. And there's been some discussion around revising it in the federal space. Can you discuss the existing challenges around financial reporting? And what are some of the initiatives that are being pursued to address some of these issues?
I absolutely love that question. As a financial manager, I never thought they'd pass the CFO Act because it made too much sense and it took too much control away and put too much sunshine on the activity, which was the intent on internal controls and on financial activities in general. 20 years later, we had the Improper Payments Elimination Recovery Act that required the CFOs and the IGs to get together and produce a report on where are we with the CFO Act and what needs to be done going forward. I was asked to lead that effort in conjunction with John Weimer, who's the IG at the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. And so we had the IGs, we had CFOs working together. We did a tremendous amount of outreach. It took us almost a year to get that report done. And we did outreach to the financial community. We had all the former controllers, except for maybe one, come in and talk about the CFO Act and their experience with it and what they thought about it. and what ought to be done. And you want to see an opinionated group, get them together. And it was fascinating. It was a lot of fun. And so we did outreach with the AGA's help. We did outreach to contract community, you know, the people who have been doing these audits and do the consulting, who actually know this stuff, and also to the financial community and to the IG community. So we went out to all these four communities. From that, this wasn't a formal evaluation or audit. This was a report based on, you know, based on what we heard from people and based on our impressions. We from academics as well. And so what we got from that was, you know, a lot of this has been tremendously successful, that we couldn't have done the things we do. We ought to be doing more in terms of having the CFO follow the same model that the CFO reports do. The CFO reports are based on a private sector model, but the CFO isn't yet. More and more, it's getting there. In the private sector, the CFO is a last stop out the door. You may have a great idea, you know, and the president of the company, I think, this is really good. Get the CFO in here. Let's talk about return on investment. Let's talk about what you're going to need to get this done. Let's see where it fits in to our earnings stream. And so that's the last stop before you go. We're not quite there. And I don't pretend that CFOs in federal government are going to be similar to exactly that. But when you talk about risk analysis, and when you talk about internal controls, and you talk about a partner with agencies, not just with the secretaries and deputy secretaries, but with the agencies themselves, there's more of that that I think needs to be done. I think that when Treasury says we spend $8 billion a year on financial reporting and auditing, there ought to be something we can do there. As a CFO, I prepare a really great-looking annual financial statement. I can tell you on one hand how many people read that thing. Several of my staff, not all of them, several of my staff do, I do, and maybe one person on the Hill, but not even them. Yeah, and yourself? Okay, good, good. I'll send you one in a couple of weeks. And it's useful. And again, there's credibility because they can audit it. And we have auditing standards. They're clear, understandable, you know, and you get a result and you get credibility. Or you can lose credibility. But, you know, you get it. But everybody's almost there now. I mean, DHS is getting close. Everybody else is there pretty much. DOD, got a ways to go. But everybody else on the civilian side is pretty much there. So why are we doing the same thing over and over again? Why are we doing the same report, getting them audited, and spending billions, not just on the financial audit, but the reporting and the staff that's involved in all this? You know, we ought to take a look at this. And one of the key recommendations to Congress that we did in the CFO RAC report was that they ought to direct OMB and FASAB and GAO and everybody, Treasury, everybody. They ought to direct that everybody get together and start looking at this and look at, you know, is there a way we ought to evolve the model? You know, we don't need to throw the baby out with the bathwater, but we can declare victory because we have victory and look at what we need going forward. You know, we do tons of internal controls. You know, we can do it based around that. We already have internal controls of opinion required going forward. So we can do it based on that. So there are things we can do and report on that make sense. When the recovery board looked at reporting, you know, they didn't use financial statements. You know, they got a lot of accolades, deservedly so, for the kind of reporting they set up. And, you know, USA spending and all that. And it was set up as well by OMB. So those things that are all set up, they don't use financial statements. That's a whole separate reporting thing that we're doing. So it makes sense to me that we look at what the real requirements are and not just say, no, stop, you know, we don't have to do anything. You know, the danger is you're always perceived as saying, well, you know, I want to change the way I have to report because I don't want to report anymore. That's not really the case. I think it ought to still be just as challenging, if not more so, but it ought to be more relevant to what we need to do.
What does the future hold for financial management at the U.S. Department of Labor? We will ask its CFO, Jim Taylor, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. What does the USDA do to promote the country's agricultural production and exports? How is EPA incorporating sustainability into its regulatory decision-making? What is the military health system's quadruple aim? How is the Maritime Administration working to enhance U.S. competitiveness? And what about DHS's acquisition and procurement strategies? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. We bring you insights and interviews from government executives who are changing the way government does business. Hear from U.S. Deputy Secretary Kathleen Merrigan, David Matsuda, Administrator of the U.S. Maritime Administration, and Dr. Jonathan Woodson, Assistant Secretary of Defense for Health Affairs. Robert Hale and Beth McGrath provide us with their insights on how DoD is changing the way it does business and leading in an era of complex challenges. All of this and more in the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine. Order a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Jim Taylor, Chief Financial Officer at the U.S. Department of Labor. Also joining us from IBM is Steve Watson. So, Jim, I have the pleasure of talking to most of my guests about the use of collaboration and partnerships to achieve mission results. Can you tell us how you're leveraging partnerships to improve your management operations?
Sure. I mean, we start with the formal structures. I mean, the CFO Council has always been very important to me. I spent a lot of time on it in my career. And I found that the work that's done there has been incredibly useful for all of us in the community. The Council on Financial Reporting that I'm on now for the grant side, I think that is going to be – that's also already been useful to the department in trying to look at what the issues are going forward with grants and how do we need to evolve our grants programs and try to make them maybe less burdensome on the reporting side from those who receive the benefits. You know, the less so in terms of collaboration and less formally – utilizing things like the online tool that we actually picked up from a vendor to do the skills assessment provided insight that I couldn't have gotten any other way, and utilizing training vendors to come in and talk to us about the kind of things they did, the kind of assessments they did, and how they looked at capabilities for training. Talking to DOD extensively about their skills assessment process. I mean, they're mandating you have to have a certification, and they, you know, so the DOD way. I mean, they're gonna go all in, and it's great. And they actually worked wonderfully with us as we devised our approach and made ours, you know, labor specific, but utilized a lot of the lessons learned from them. I think the collaboration that we did on the CFO Act 20th anniversary report. Last year provided great insight to what's going on across the government. You know, utilizing the AGA like many of us do for different activities, you know, those professional organizations to try to help us call out what's going on. You know, the CFO survey they do every year. I mean, those kind of things provide really useful information to folks like me. And again, you know, having been around forever, it also helps that a lot of the folks that are in and out of government right now that have done and seen a lot of the things that I'm doing and seeing are still around and have been great mentors.
Jim, given the importance of financial information plays in program delivery, how do you think the role of the CFO has evolved to become more of a strategic business partner in support of the department? What are some of the key characteristics to become an effective CFO?
Well, I think in specific to the Department of Labor, I think the partnering as we've tried to with our agencies, as we went through the difficult times with the financial system and with financial reporting and to try to streamline the activities has really helped develop a relationship, you know, that I think both of us benefit from. We've done a couple studies for the department, for agencies on financial activities that have resulted in organizational changes in order to more effectively carry out the financial functions. In my case, working closely with the Inspector General has been tremendous in terms of what where they see the issues lying, because whenever you have an IG, and the vast majority of them are, who just want to get the job done and make the right changes, you know, partnering with them is actually critical to a CFO. The CFO role in the department has evolved because there's a credibility there now, I think. They went through a lot of tough times, and sometimes management doesn't understand what a CFO is there for. Everybody's focused on the budget. You know, and if you have the budget, and I have a piece of the budget, but I don't have the formulation, you know, it makes a CFO, like at Labor and some other departments, makes it more difficult. So you have to develop that credibility by providing useful functions, by bringing something to the table, putting the system in place that makes things easier, providing the reporting that they can really use. I think those are the keys for a CFO to be more relevant, and particularly at Labor. Overall, I see the role evolving tremendously across the government. now, I mean, if you look around, you don't have a lot of accountants that are CFOs or even financial types. We have economists. We have a lot of budget folks, which has been the case before. We have a number of budget folks. We even have a natural resources specialist who's an acting CFO in one department. So we have a whole range of individuals who are performing the function because it reflects how the CFO role has changed. When we first started this exercise in the 90s, after the CFO Act was passed, you know, we had to get clean opinions. You had to understand how accounting worked. You had to understand, you know, USSGL. You know, you had to get your hands dirty with this stuff. Well, in most departments, we're way past that. And so now they're looking at the CFO to have a broader range of experience, to understand a lot more issues, and to be a partner in more administrative areas and more risk assessment type areas. So I think that's and that moves towards when I talked about the CFO and the private sector model. That's where I see things moving gradually. I'd like to push that along, of course, but that's where I do see the role evolving, and you see it already. And it's, if you take a snapshot of CFOs today versus 1995, I think you'll see the same thing.
Jim, is there any emerging technologies that hold promise for improving the work that CFOs do?
Yeah, I think two huge things for us is going to be mobile technology, which we already make use of in the department, and the telework. And all the technologies surrounding with enabling telework, the security issues and all that, resolving all of those. That's going to be huge for us. And I think, you know, in terms of telework, I'll take the easy one first. You know, my office has more than half of our folks with a telework agreement in place right now. If superstorms hit this winter, you know, we have another snowmageddon like we did a few years ago, we're going to be able to perform our functions and still get payments out on time. Without anybody having to endanger themselves by getting in the car or coming. The Bureau of Labor Statistics has certain reports that have to be out no matter what. And they get them out because they've been doing telework and they have focused on telework for a number of years. The rest of us are coming behind in the same thing. I think it doesn't matter to me, to be completely honest, where most of my staff are at any given moment. What I care about is the results. And that's what all of us are starting to care about more and more. 10 years ago, you would never have seen the number of people teleworking that are now. And it's not just technological change. It's a management change. I mean, people like me, old-timers like me, you know, you come around and you think, you know, do I have to reach out and touch everybody? You know, no, I just need to know they're doing their job. But if you hire the right people or you make sure that you're measuring the right things for those people, you know, then they will. And so it's no different than in the office. I mean, if you have someone who's not going to perform for you in a telework environment, yeah, it's they're not going to perform for you when they're sitting in the office. The only difference is that they're using their own computer, you know, to play games on, you know, not yours. So I think those are for telework, that's it. I think in terms of the mobile technology, I mean, we would like nothing better than to get to a place where we can make sure our invoices are being paid, no matter where that person is, if they're on the road, that they can process their travel voucher, because a lot of our folks stay on the road all the time. Personnel actions, that we can get to the point where a lot of the administrative functions can be performed without ever having to sit behind a desk. And so I think that's where we're moving towards. So those are the technological changes. I think they're really good. The third is one we talked about a lot. That's the cloud-based technologies. Everybody's moving towards email. Our department's moving towards email in the cloud. I like to point out to our CIO's office that will be the second implementation in the cloud for the department, that the first was a financial system. But the key there is that, you know, you don't have to maintain infrastructures. You don't have to hire hard to get IT people. Somebody else does it. You don't have to maintain the licenses. You know, if somebody else worries about those. But, you know, those are the kinds of things that now in a static environment, you have to do yourself. If you have an environment where somebody whose core responsibility is doing IT knows how to do that. You know, my core responsibility is financial management and a bunch of other stuff, but financial management is my core responsibility. That's what I do best. The tools that let me do that, you know, are something somebody else probably does better than I do. So we want to more and more let them do that.
Jim, as we turn to the future, I'd like to get your sense of some of the key issues that will affect federal CFOs in the next few years, and more particularly about your office. What are some of the opportunities you see your office will engage in, and how do you seek to address those?
I think really measuring the